We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or visit preborn.com.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. It is Friday, January 31st, and as more information comes out about the absolutely tragic mid-air collision of the American Airlines plane and the Army helicopter, the officials have recovered some key evidence, including the black box aboard the American Airlines Flight 5342. So the National Transportation Safety Board, or the NTSB, has recovered that critical evidence that could piece together some of the final moments before Wednesday's deadly mid-air collision. This coming from Fox News this morning. And we will continue, as President Trump said in his press conference yesterday, to pray for the families of the victims, of everyone involved. And it will be just really interesting to see what the NTSB recovers and how quickly that information is released to the public. And meanwhile, it was a busy day yesterday on Capitol Hill, as three of President Trump's nominees for cabinet had their confirmation hearings. RFK Jr. had his second round of confirmation hearings and was sparring against a lot of the Democrat senators and just dropping a lot of truth bombs. And one of the more fiery exchanges came between RFK and Senator Bernie Sanders on a lot of D.C., including senators receiving big pharma money. This is Cut 17.
The problem of corruption is not just in the federal agencies. It's in Congress, too. Almost all the members of this panel are accepting, including yourself, are accepting millions of dollars from the pharmaceutical industry.
Protecting their interests. I ran for president like you. I got millions of contributions. They did not come from the executives, not one nickel of PAC money from the pharmaceutical industry. They came from workers.
In 2020, you were the single largest
because I have
received pharmaceutical money.
I just love it when the tables are turned and these nominees are putting the Democrats actually on defense. And that also happened in Kash Patel's hearing and also Tulsi Gabbard. And Senator Mike Lee in Kash Patel's hearing actually said that he's the first FBI director that's been interviewed by the Senate in the over a decade that Mike Lee has been in the Senate that has not outright lied about the FBI to the Senate. Isn't that incredible? This is one of Senator Lee's comments on Cash not lying to the senators. Cut 15.
I've been a U.S. senator for 14 years. I've been on this committee the entire time. You are the very first FBI director or FBI director nominee who, when I've asked about this, hasn't said, oh, don't worry about it. We'll handle it okay. We've got good people on the inside. We would never breach the trust of the American people.
And Kash Patel also said in response to some of the questioning that his singular mission is to impose a standard of transparency and justice. This is Cut 16.
And anyone that thinks my 16 years of service isn't exemplary on how I would proceed if confirmed as FBI is intentionally putting false information into the public ether and creating more public discourse. The only thing that will matter if I'm confirmed as a director of the FBI is a de-weaponized, depoliticized system of law enforcement completely devoted to rigorous obedience of the Constitution and a singular standard of justice.
I love it. And Tulsi Gabbard said in her very fiery open statement that she refuses to be a puppet, and all of the opposition and the political opposition against her confirmation that is, in her words, outright lying about her, is that she refuses to be a puppet of the swamp. Cut 11.
Before I close, I want to warn the American people who are watching at home. You may hear lies and smears in this hearing that'll challenge my loyalty to and my love for our country. Those who oppose my nomination imply that I am loyal to something or someone other than God, my own conscience, and the Constitution of the United States. Accusing me of being Trump's puppet, Putin's puppet, Assad's puppet, a guru's puppet, Modi's puppet, not recognizing the absurdity of simultaneously being the puppet of five different puppet masters. The same tactic was used against President Trump and failed. The American people elected President Trump with a decisive victory and mandate for change. The fact is, what truly unsettles my political opponents is I refuse to be their puppet.
So well said. And I, for one, am loving how much Donald Trump's nominees are just pushing back against all of the rhetoric and are not concerned whatsoever about offending these Democrats. They are just speaking the truth. But let's welcome in Scott Uhlinger, who is a former intelligence officer. And Scott, I just love that all three of these hearings that were going on were just pushing back against all of the nonsense and the formulated talking points and these ridiculous gotcha questions from the Democrats on the panel. I thought everybody did well. But let's start first with Tulsi Gabbard, who we just listened to. There are reports that because her advancement out of that committee is a closed vote, that may give cover for some Republicans, and the committee is only 9-8 Republican. And so if there is a switch of even one Republican vote and all Democrats oppose, she may not even advance to the full floor vote. I hope we don't see that. What's your take? And good morning.
Good morning there, Jenna. I think it's absolutely disgraceful that such a thing is even being considered. I read that the last time a secret vote was held in Congress was in the year 1799. So these people are so faithless that they're afraid of risking the wrath of the American people, the very fact that they want to have a secret ballot. So hopefully the president and the constituents can pressure these people to not go through with that apparent plan, because it just shows you, and as you said, that with the interviews of all three nominees, it just, these people have just absolutely disgraced themselves and shown themselves to be the corrupt, demonic people that we think they are. And in fact, there have been a number of quotes on social media by Democrats who, having seen this, having seen the way that their representatives behave, are utterly shocked and dismayed to see this, and saying things like, I'm never going to vote for another Democrat again because of what I've just seen. So all three candidates, I agree, did really well. And I have faith that in the end, pressure from the people will compel Congress to do the right thing despite itself.
I hope so. And that's remarkable. I actually didn't even know that fact about the last time the Senate held a secret vote like that, which the transparency is key here. And this is what part of the Trump's mandate, I think, from voters is a demand for more transparency. And even if they hold a secret vote, you know that that's going to leak likely at some point. And I would not want to be that Republican senator that is voting against Tulsi Gabbard and incurs the wrath of, you know, the social media mob and really the voters as well. But what's really the main reason for opposing Tulsi Gabbard? I mean, all of the opposition questions, somehow suggesting that her loyalty is to somewhere other than, as she mentioned, the U.S. Constitution or the United States of America. It seems like that just has absolutely no backing. Why is that even coming up?
Because it seems as though it's the same reason why are they fighting RFK so much? And it's basically because she threatens to upend the special interests that have been driving U.S. intelligence. She is not going to, she's going to do what she believes is the right thing. She's going to be more transparent than ever. And these kinds of things are a threat to the powers that be, represented by the Democrats. And so they want to do anything to stop her. And levying all of these things against, you know, a serving lieutenant colonel in the Army Reserve is insane. I mean, because I get very well, I'm the equivalent rank in the Navy. And so I imagine, as I watch these things, that, believe me, if I was sitting there in that position to be nominated for the DNI, they would be saying the exact same things about me. You know, another person who's dedicated their whole life to serving their country. And I know that in my heart. They would absolutely be accusing me of the same things. And so it's just ridiculous. And I think that she will bring, you know, genuine reform to the DNI. The DNI itself is, I mean, hopefully she would work at eliminating her own organization, because the DNI is kind of, an obsolete relic left from 9/11, because the Director of National Intelligence was a position that only was created by Bush after 9/11. And it's basically this huge intelligence bureaucracy that really doesn't offer a lot of value added.
It's really amazing how many things since 9/11 have contributed to the increase of the swamp and spying on the American people and undercutting constitutionally protected rights. And Tulsi was even asked about Edward Snowden and some posts where she was lauding him for whistleblowing. And I thought that she threaded the needle well by acknowledging that he broke the law, but simultaneously saying, but he released information that led to the transformation of a lot of these policies that was actually good for the United States. I mean, this was one of those gotcha questions. But let's listen to her response on this, cut 14.
Do you still think Edward Snowden is brave?
Mr. Vice Chairman, Edward Snowden broke the law. I do not agree with or support with all of the information and intelligence that he released, nor the way in which he did it. There would have been opportunities for him to come to you on this committee or seek out the IG to release that information. The fact is, he also, even as he broke the law, released information that exposed egregious, illegal, and unconstitutional programs that are happening within our government.
Excuse me,
that led to serious reforms that Congress undertook.
I love how the senator is trying to interrupt her, going like, you know, don't speak the truth about right. that. I only have a few minutes. So but I thought she threaded that well.
I think she did, because that's one case that I really am quite unsure about. And so basically I would have answered the same way, because that all went down when I was in the agency. But I believe that there could have been a lot of propaganda about that, because the information that was revealed showed that they were violating U.S. Civil rights. So afterward, like, in other words, I thought he was a traitor when I was in the agency. But then later on, I start realizing that the way that the federal government was casting it may be because he was informing about the violation of civil rights. And I think, as she pointed out, the answer is somewhere in between. He is no saint, but some of the things he brought to the attention of the American people are a good thing. So I think that was, like, basically a perfect answer, the kind of answer I would have given.
Yeah, and I think that that type of acknowledgement, I mean, she didn't walk it back. She didn't just capitulate and try to give those senators the answers that they wanted and that they wanted to trap her in order to hopefully win confirmation, because she knows that they're not going to vote for her anyway. And so this is all just entrapment. And it reminds me, Scott Uhlinger, of how well Pam Bondi did in her confirmation hearings. I thought her responses likewise were forthcoming, were forthright, and were aggressive, not just capitulating to the Senate and trying, like a politician, to win over your constituency with campaign promises. I mean, it seems like modern confirmation hearings almost go in that direction, where they really shouldn't. I mean, this is someone who, in Tulsi Gabbard and Kash Patel, Pam Bondi, and even RFK, that are defending the reason that Trump nominated them to those positions. And I love to see this, because we really haven't seen seen a lot of that type of more assertive responses, I think, in a while from confirmation hearings.
It's true, and it's very, very much welcome, because I certainly would have, I would strike this exact same thing. I mean, one of almost defiance, because these people are corrupt who are, quote, interrogating you. And so, you know, the truth will out, and and these people, they're not going to let anyone push them around. It was the same thing with Pete Hegseth as well. I mean, you know, the allegations that were thrown against all of them are ridiculous. And some of them may be better or worse. I mean, maybe they're all not perfect, but the bottom line is they are all qualified for the job. When you compare, for instance, the fact that, you know, so many Republicans overwhelmingly voted for people who were clearly not up to the job, and that were just given, rubber stamped through Congress under the Biden administration. I mean, there was talking about the awful aviation tragedy, which is the worst since 9/11, by the way. There was, during the confirmation of the head of the FAA, head of the FAA was asked a question about IFF systems, identification friend or foe, like basically a safety system the aircraft have, an electronic system. And he didn't know enough about that to even answer the question. This was the guy who was going to be head of the FAA. But that was par for the course in the Biden administration. It was absolutely disgusting to see that again on social media yesterday.
Yeah, absolutely. And what a great point, too, that, you know, these are the same senators who are pushing back and suggesting that Trump's nominees aren't qualified, when you literally had dudes in dresses that thought that they were qualified and they were part of the Biden administration. I mean, all of these people in Trump's cabinet are 100% upgrades. And so, but speaking about the corruption on the government side, I mean, this isn't just Democrats, though. And that's the concern, really, that I have in terms of actually getting these last three pushed through. I think Kash Patel will get confirmed. Tulsi and RFK will be narrower margins, perhaps, and even like Pete Hegseth, you know, coming down to 50-50 on the floor, and Vice President J.D. Vance having to come in and cast that tie-breaking vote. It may be that some Republicans don't want to vote for these nominees for, unfortunately, the same reason as Democrats. And that just signals the uniparty that these nominees are intended to address and actually drain the swamp that happened in part in Trump's first term, but not nearly enough. So what is your prediction in just the last 2 minutes we have with you, Scott Uhlinger, of where each nominee will go from here?
I think that your assessment is on target. I think you're right that RFK and that they will be RFK and Tulsi Gabbard will be harder to get through, but Patel will probably get through a little bit easier. I think that that is true, and for exactly the reasons you pointed out, that there, look, let's face it, there are Republicans who are corrupt too. There's no question about that. The uniparty, as you said, and those people, they need to be punished. They need to be thrashed by their voters. You know, already people are talking about, you know, funding primary challengers, and that absolutely needs to be done. That was one of the main reasons that Hegseth barely squeaked through, was because of that pressure that was on, and they were on social media, people were pledging that they are going to, you know, people with funds, that they were going to primary challenge these dissenters, and that was only enough to get him just passed and confirmed. So without that kind of a pressure, these people will feel that they can somehow, you know, upset, basically thwart the will of the people. And we've got to keep on fighting against that. And this, it's things like this that show us this is exactly why Trump was elected, because people are sick and tired of this corruption that has existed for 40 years, and it's only the first Trump administration that really brought most Americans' attention to that fact. And hopefully we'll be able to work at making a severe dent in this corruption during this term.
Yeah, so well said. And that's the action item for everyone listening, is to call your senators and tell them how you feel about these confirmations, because it is the voice and the will of the people that resoundingly rejected the left in 2024. And it's going to be our voice again that continues to help President Trump actually do our will and the will of the people and self-govern and drain the swamp. So call your senators on all three of these nominees. And for Floridians, you're going to want to call your representatives and senators because of what we're going to talk about with Senator Jay Collins coming up right after this. This Sanctity of Life Month, we honor the over 66 million babies whose lives have been tragically ended through abortion since Roe versus Wade. Sadly, with the abortion pill accounting for over 60% of all abortions, babies' lives are at even greater risk now. But in the midst of this darkness, there is a light that shines, and that's Preborn. Preborn's network of clinics have rescued over 300,000 babies from abortion and have prayed with over 80,000 women to come to Christ.
When I heard her heartbeat, I decided to keep her. And now my daughter's about to be three. I don't know where my life would be without her.
An ultrasound doubles a baby's chance at life. This is Jenna Ellis asking you to join Preborn in protecting life. One ultrasound session costs $28, and $140 will sponsor five ultrasounds. Any gift will help, $100, $200, even $1,000. To donate securely, dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby, or go to preborn.com/AFR. Preborn.com/AFR.
Speaking truth with love. This is Jenna Ellis in the morning.
Welcome back. And the state of Florida is undergoing a lot of drama, if you've been following this, with the upcoming likely veto from Governor Ron DeSantis of the so-called Trump Act, which the Rhino-led Republican legislature that really shouldn't be the opposition passed this week during the special session that really waters down immigration authority and seeks to transfer enforcement to the Commissioner of Agriculture of all people. And it looks like a political stunt. And of course, they just named the Trump Act that so that the voting public and the constituency would think, oh, yeah, this is totally along with and aligns with Trump's priorities. But I think it's falsely named. And Governor DeSantis joined me yesterday on the program to talk about how the grassroots in Florida has just risen up like no other time and is pushing back against this and supports his veto. This is a little bit of what he had to say yesterday.
I think what's happened is I've had to overcome a lot of this over the years to be able to do conservative policy. But I would tell you, there's a difference between a Republican majority and a conservative majority. We had a conservative majority the last 2 years. What I've seen out of the leader so far is that they're moving left and they're trying to have a more liberal majority than what we've been accustomed to in Florida. And that's not going to fly. Why would you give the Democrats a lifeline? We've rendered them irrelevant in the state. And there's even talk that the Senate doesn't have enough votes to override a veto, that they would water down their bill further to try to attract Democrats to override my veto. Think about what that says.
So Senator Jay Collins, who is a Florida state senator and has been speaking truth on this and opposing this watered down legislation, joins me now. And Senator, I think the governor was spot on.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, the governor's been spot on for years. Florida is in the position it is because of his leadership. We've had a strong majority pushing strong legislation. Florida has led. Florida has to lead here. And frankly, this air quote Trump Act is not what we need to do. It is not a fitting bill. He is spot on here.
Yeah. So where are we at in terms of Florida's supermajority? I mean, I think he was also spot on again to say that there's a difference between a Republican majority and a conservative majority. It seems like this coalition of the Florida Speaker of the House and the President of the Senate and others who are supporting this have a different motivation in mind. And I think that this was very clearly evident from Senator Joe Gruters, who I think, said the quiet part out loud. This is cut 10.
You trust Wilton Simpson.
Okay.
100%. He has the integrity, the ethics, and by the way, I mean, this is not a secret. He does want to continue to move up in the world of politics. I don't think that's a secret. So what do you guys think will happen? Do you think that he wants to make President Trump happy by making sure he's probably the strongest enforcer of illegal immigration in the country? I would tend to believe it. You got Randy Fine. Thank you for those kind words. 81, 82%. The endorsement match.
All right. So, Senator Collins, I think it's pretty clear that they're just trying to prop up Wilton Simpson as perhaps the successor to Governor DeSantis. Has anybody asked him if he's actually going to serve all 6 years, or is he kind of planning to run in 2 years and just wants to say, hey, Governor DeSantis didn't do anything on immigration and look at everything that I've done as in, not the governor, but the commissioner of agriculture? I mean, that to me is pretty obvious.
Yeah, look, it's expressing exactly what it was meant to, right? It is saying the silent part out loud, and they're getting absolutely hammered for it. This is hurting them. It truly is. It looks like old school Tallahassee or even old school New York style politics. Americans don't want that. There is a clear push from the American people and from Florida, as it has been for years now, to do the best conservative policy. They want a leader who is courageous, willing to do what's right, and solve critical problems. More money in their pockets, safe, secure borders, and this legislation should be put out there in the strongest manner possible. Wilton Simpson, this look, take the person out, disregard all that. Let's look exactly at the role he's in. He's the Ag Commissioner. This is express executive powers in our Constitution given to the governor of the state of Florida. This is performative in nature to remove it. There is no basis where this is correct, and I have no doubt that that's going to have to get fixed for this thing to move forward. Governor is led. We need to follow his lead on this and do the right thing.
So with the veto expected and anticipated, does the veto, is it override proof when you look at where the House and the Senate are right now in supporting the governor over this watered down legislation?
Yeah, so when the House voted, they do have the ability to override in the House, but we do not in the Senate. This thing passed with only 21 votes. It was very close. You know, there were several of us, myself, Blaise Ngolia, John Martin, who stood for a while. We had a couple others join in as well. And I'm thankful for that. I'm grateful they stood with their values and conservative values at that. And ultimately, it's really close. So we're not going to override this. This thing's going to have more work done to it. And it's going to come back for round two whenever the governor gets to veto this.
And so looking ahead over the next 2 years of Governor DeSantis's leadership, a lot of the grassroots in Florida who are very understandably upset about all of this and who have loved Governor DeSantis's leadership and want to see Florida stay conservative, not just Republican, are asking the question, you know, is it time to get behind a successor to Governor DeSantis? And I asked him that question yesterday, and he mentioned, you know, that he'll support a strong conservative candidate. Is there talk in the conservative coalition in the House and the Senate about a successor?
Well, I think that's really what a lot of this is about, is they're trying to put people up from both sides. And who that's going to be, you know, I think there are many people who are eyeballing it. You know, some in Congress, I'm told, some here in the state of Florida, and we'll give it a few more weeks for that to flush out. But what we unequivocally know is they've got big shoes to fill. The governor is a difference maker. He has that sixth sense of when to push, when to get critical things through, and he's usually ahead of many people on that. He's fearless. You have to follow up with the exact same capability. You have to lean in without fear, and you have to unequivocally do what's right. One of the things I told him when I jumped into the Senate and we had our first conversation, I love how he gives a task, a condition, and a standard, and he follows up, and he does what's right. Doesn't matter whether it's hard or easy. That is the type of servant leadership we have to have in the state of Florida. So whoever's next needs to do that.
Absolutely. And, you know, there has been talk as well that and the proponents of this watered down bill have said that they have spoken directly to President Trump on this and almost in a way to try to signal to voters that they are just circumventing Governor DeSantis and trying to cast him as irrelevant to this process. My comment on social media the other day was, you know, I think that probably the Speaker of the House and President of the Senate got one of those like robo messages from President Trump, you know, saying, hey, this is Trump that, you know, I want to golf with you. And they think that that's actually talking to the president. But I, you know, I haven't seen President Trump come out and comment and support this at all. And you would think that if they were that connected with him, that he would support this legislation. Meanwhile, he's been very supportive of Governor DeSantis, who's been in contact with Tom Homan and, you know, in lockstep with this administration on immigration enforcement. So, you know, is that something that potentially will come back to bite them when I think that they're overplaying their hand a little bit?
Yeah, look, if the president were going to weigh in, he would have weighed in by now, right? The silence is deafening. And the point that really drives that home is listen to the grassroots. The president understands what is going on, what's at stake, and he understands what the people are looking for. He wants the strongest immigration bill possible. And backdoor amnesty is not it. Unconstitutional issues that are going to get thrown out invalidate the entire thing. He expects Florida to lead. And, you know, we talked about it last time I was on. I'm a military guy. I was a Green Beret for 23 years. I did 5 years after I lost my leg. When you get ready to do hard things, you need serious people. Serious times call for serious leaders. Governor DeSantis is a serious leader. He gets things done. You're not going to lock that person, push him back, and not listen to what he can do. You're going to put him up there on the front line and just get him on task and help him save our nation. Governor DeSantis has shown he's willing to do that.
Absolutely. And Florida voters are very grateful for his leadership on this. And we want to see and I say we because I'm one of them. I mean, I moved 2 years ago to this state because of the conservative leadership, because of Governor DeSantis, and hopefully helping a conservative supermajority continue to lead. And so as voters are rising up against this, do you think that that's going to really have any sort of impact on these rhino, for lack of a better term, leaders to maybe change their position? Or have they just been ignoring their own constituents?
It's pretty hard to ignore. I've had hundreds and thousands of contacts, whether it's been on social media, phone calls to my office. I mean, we're well into high triple digits, if not four digits. Emails, the grassroots, regular moms and dads, people who aren't generally political are speaking clearly on this. I've had it from all over the state. I'm sure my colleagues are the same way. Florida's speaking on this. And to your point, people moved here for what we've done in the past. We have set the tone. We have led the way. And the expectation is we're going to continue to do it. I kind of feel like in the movie 300, when they're saying this is Sparta, it kind of feels the same way. This is Florida, right? We're going to kick the nonsense, the rhinos into the pit, and we're going to move forward. We're going to do what's right. That's what we have to do. Ultimately, they can try to ignore it, but the voices are loud. The people are pushing, and the people want leadership on this subject.
Well, I look forward to that meme being posted on your social media very soon. This is Florida. Thanks so much, Senator Jay Collins. We'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Thank you, Jen. I appreciate you.
Speaking truth with love. This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Welcome back. And as Trump has continued to sign the flurry of executive orders, and as the focus really has been a lot on immigration, of course, with everything that we just discussed coming out of the state of Florida, that watered down bill, and Governor DeSantis wanting to actually be in lockstep with President Trump. Also, Vice President J.D. Vance went on CBS in his first interview, which is interesting, with clearly opposition media. And the question of immigration came up. And of course, the left is suggesting that, you know, we're a nation of immigrants. And, you know, how dare you not have, you know, the language that's on that's in New York on the Statue of Liberty as codified law instead of a poem. I mean, it's just utterly ridiculous. Our good friend Jeremy Carl, who is an author and senior fellow at the Claremont Institute, wrote a piece actually back in 2022, and it was actually a transcript from a speech at an event entitled Lies of the Ruling Class that was hosted back in May 2022 that's titled Whom Does Perpetual Immigration Serve? And it's really interesting to see that a lot of the policies that he has been advocating for have really made their way into what the Trump administration largely and states like Governor DeSantis in Florida are trying to do with immigration. And the difference, as J.D. Vance mentioned, with America being a nation of settlers, not a nation of immigrants. And I think that's a really important distinction. So Jeremy Carl joins me now to discuss. And I think this is a really great distinction, Jeremy.
Yeah, absolutely. And just for your audience to kind of understand what it is that an immigrant is somebody who's moving to an established society, and a settler or pioneer is somebody who is creating a new society. And so what we have, as I argue in my piece, in the first really couple hundred years mostly of U.S. In the history of America, we were almost exclusively in many ways a nation of settlers, you know, really pioneering a new society. Not, of course, that people were not there, but we weren't joining their society. We were making a new one. And then you kind of move, as I argue, into kind of a mixed period of settlement and immigration. But really, we kind of only sort of have a kind of pure immigration mindset, really starting in the late 19th, early 20th century. And we don't begin to talk about a nation of immigrants until the Democrats need it for the 1960 presidential campaign.
Yeah, and it's really fascinating to see, you know, how this conversation around immigration has really, I think, been lied about by the Democrats. I mean, pretty much like they do everything. I mean, they have their talking points that are they're trying to just evoke this type of emotion, like, oh, you know, how dare you deport women and children when, you know, a lot of these are criminals. They're young men of fighting age. They are, you know, people who have already committed multiple crimes, or have been deported or coming back. I mean, those are the people that the left doesn't want to talk about. And so what's the truth about immigration in terms of what President Trump is trying to accomplish and what conservatives actually need to be supporting?
Yeah, well, I think President Trump is doing the smartest thing, both substantively and in terms of, I think, how we're talking about it, which is to say we're going first after more criminal aliens. And the fact that the Democrats are even fighting back against that, as you just kind of alluded to, just really shows kind of how insane and off the reservation, and by the way, I mean deeply unpopular, they have. And at the same time, I think it's important that we are saying, and we are saying this, that we're not just limited to criminal aliens. So that if we're encountering people, anybody here, in the course of whatever police work or anything else that we're doing, who we know is not here legally, the fact that they're not otherwise committing criminal acts does not mean we're going to overlook the criminal act of their illegal entry, and they are still eligible for being deported, and in fact they will be. And I think that is the right positioning, to show that we actually are a focus on getting out the worst folks, but there's not amnesty for anybody. We are going after every illegal alien in this country, and we're going to send them back to their home countries.
Yeah, and you mentioned in your speech, which is, of course, in this this transcript that's titled A Nation of Settlers, and it's at The American Mind, which is a publication of the Claremont Institute. And you cite David Azarod, who's also said in a speech that back around 2022, quote, "There is simply no precedent in human history for sovereign states voluntarily importing into their homelands untold millions of people of different colors, creeds, and cultures for decades on end. This is what tyrants do to conquer a broken people, to pacify them. It is not something that the natives willfully do themselves," unquote. And I think, as you mentioned in your speech, that's right on the money, because we've seen the lack of assimilation in the United States, a lack of even our elites wanting to affirm American culture, be America first. All of those things are things that President Trump stands for. And of course, he's called a racist and some of these other pejoratives while doing so. But the point remains that in order to have a sovereign nation, nations have to have boundaries physical boundaries that are enforceable. And if we don't do that under some kind of notion of, you know, humanitarianism or some kind of feckless leadership, then really all we're doing is watering down the value of citizenship, which is exactly what his executive order is pointing to.
No, absolutely. We are not just some group of global citizens. We're a nation. We're a people. We have to maintain our borders for that reason. There has to be an us that is in distinction to a them, that is other people out there. And this sort of misguided, I mean, to call it even humanitarianism is a little bit too kind. I mean, I think it comes from some sort of well of deep left-wing self-hatred and lack of regard for their fellow citizens that this has gone on and just in increasing numbers for decades, so that somebody like me who's I'm 52, I'm not that young, but I'm not that old either. I mean, I grew up in a totally different America demographically from America today, and nobody voted on that. We had that due to the fecklessness and maliciousness of our leadership.
Yeah, and I think you're seeing that whether it's sort of nostalgia or, you know, kind of harking back even to just a few decades ago, that America really was a vastly different place, even in terms of our leadership and its priorities, the distinctions and the transformation that you've seen the leftists with their woke nonsense, their cultural Marxism, I mean, all kinds of different areas and their priorities. That really doesn't look the same as the America that certainly not that we were founded on, but even that we were a couple of decades ago. It was fascinating to me, Jeremy Carl, my special guest this morning, to even hear RFK Jr. Talking about that in his confirmation hearings, about how during his uncle's presidency in the Kennedy administration, he was saying, you know, you didn't have this high of a population with chronic disease. Like hardly anyone had chronic disease. We spent $0 as a country on this. And now we're spending, you know, billions and billions of dollars on chronic disease. I mean, something fundamentally shifted. And so I think it's not just immigration policy. It's not just health policy. It's not just DEI policy. It's kind of this cultural transformation as a whole. What, by and large, do you attribute that massive shift to, just in the way that Americans perceive America?
Well, I think there's a lot of things going on. We could probably spend several segments talking about it, but just to, I think, maybe keep the focus on the things we were just talking about, I think a huge portion of it is we changed who the American people were, and we imported millions and millions of people from very different cultures with different cultural assumptions, with less ties to the U.S. And, you know, by the way, I'm actually not at all an immigrant basher. I mean, I understand why a lot of those folks want to come, and a lot of those folks will actually have been and will be great Americans, assuming they're coming legally. But, I mean, there's been a change, and so you see these very different sort of cultural attitudes because there's not a shared culture and not a shared cultural assumption.
Yeah, and not having a shared cultural assumption, I think, is really spot on in terms of part of the problem, because we used to be a nation that was fixed around the concepts and the principles of our Declaration of Independence, of recognizing the sovereign right of the people to have a government that recognizes and enforces that our rights come from God, our creator, not that government. And the sole purpose of government is to preserve and protect our rights. And so we established this country on a very different premise than other nations that have leaders based on conquest and power or heritage or you know, some of these other ways, instead of a fixed moral premise. And America and American exceptionalism, I think, is so critically different because of our founding worldview. And it's also amazing to me that we could unanimously from Congress declare that in 1776, where you can't even get Congress to unanimously agree on, like, you know, what day it is, practically. I mean, they agree on nothing.
Yeah.
And yet, that's part of the problem, is that we are so multicultural that we don't have unity, only diversity on even critical fundamental issues like what it means to be a nation.
Absolutely. And I mean, I have people often say diversity is our strength, and I say not at all. You know, unity is our strength, and we need to get unity from the diversity that we have. You know, I should add, obviously, if you go completely to the extreme in one or the other direction, you either get, like, pure fascism or chaos. I'm not suggesting that, like, we all need to be speaking with exactly one voice, but we need vastly more unity in the country right now. And the way that we get vastly more unity, I mean, there's a lot of things that we need to do, but we need to have a pause on immigration so that we can reconstitute American culture, reconstitute understanding of who we are as a people with a shared story, with a shared tradition, with a shared history. And at that point, I think some of this rancor will go down. And, you know, I think until we do that, we're just going to continue to have the Democrats trying to import more and more chaos, destructiveness, and divisiveness in the country, regardless, by the way, of whether any of these people coming in are really nice people individually. It's the very kind of form of mass immigration itself in our current society that is the problem.
And I'm speaking with Jeremy Carl, who is an author and senior fellow at the Claremont Institute. And I know that a lot of great thinkers, you know, like you and others at Claremont, really want to have this kind of cultural shift to return back to a fundamental ideology of American exceptionalism rather than what the left has eroded over the years. How can we do that as a society and actually make headway with the opportunities we have over the next 4 years of a Trump presidency that's winning on a lot of these issues like immigration and have that cultural shift, especially for, you know, the Gen Zers who are just coming into maturity, maybe voting for the first time in either the 2024 election or, you know, soon in 2028 to get America at least the ball rolling in the correct direction.
Right. Well, I think it's a lot of things. And I think the good news is a lot of those things Trump is trying to do. And I think the even better news is a lot of those things Trump can do, at least to some degree, even without Congress. So you get more patriotic education. And again, Trump has talked a lot about this. And this doesn't, of course, mean that we are selling some sort of fake version of American history, but it's just more of the orientation is more of one of taking pride in our country while acknowledging, of course, times that we've fallen short of that. Again, you know, if you get control of the border, I think that's the number one thing that we can do. I think changing the sorts of cultural priorities in terms of cultural funding that we're doing for this government, beginning to work on the right to strengthen the development of our own cultural products, which is something we need to do a lot better than we've been doing. But I think it's kind of a multi-factor thing. We're not just going to be able to flip a switch and do things tomorrow. But I do think that, you know, the good news is people follow incentives. And if we change the financial incentives for cultural production, for immigration, et cetera, I think that we really can begin to get some significant movement on this. And by the way, I think we already are beginning to see, people have talked a lot about, oh, the zeitgeist is changing or whatever. I think the fact that the left threw all the ridiculous things that they did throw at Trump in 2024 and it didn't work, that Trump was elected anyway. I think the left, at some fundamental level, they're kind of speaking from the same script, but they understand that that script isn't working with the American people. And so I'm hoping that they can move to something a little bit more productive.
Yeah, and in just about the last 30 seconds or so I have with you, Jeremy Carl, you can follow him at Real Jeremy Carl on X. His new book is out, The Unprotected Class, How Anti-White Racism is Tearing America Apart. What do you expect in terms of further executive orders in the first 100 days from Trump?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, he's just been moving really, really quickly, but I think we'll see even more orders probably that give him a freer hand on deporting illegal immigrants. I think we'll see a lot of orders around education and patriotic education. I think I already just saw something yesterday. It's so hard to keep track of them,
right,
about reviving the 1776 Project, et cetera.
Yeah, it's great. I love that he's going at such a fast pace that the media can't keep up with what they want to criticize. And so he's getting so much done. But Jeremy Carl, really appreciate your time. And it's time for America to come back to its founding. And we need to be America again. And so I'm all for it, for President Trump going after this. But we are already out of time for today. As always, you can reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net. And catch the newest episode streaming today of On Demand with Jenna Ellis, our exclusive AFR podcast at AFR.net. We're doing a deep dive into pro-life policy and what we need to focus on as conservatives and Christians for the next 4 years. We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.